And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Tom N. from Alpine.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Tom Navarez. I used to really like this, and now I hate it. But it's my turn, and I take my turn. I hate being a GSR, too. I did that for 12 years, and now I just signed up for another two. It's like, I don't know if you've ever been to one of those area assemblies, but I think they should pass out razor blades at the door. It's but somebody's got to do it, you know? So anyway, my sobriety date is, it's so funny. I start talking, immediately I get cottonmouth. So my sobriety date is January 3rd of 1989. My home group is the We Group. We meet on Monday nights at 6:30. That's a step in tradition study, old school AA, if you like that. We're on 33rd and Mead. At that same location, we also have a speaker meeting on Thursday nights. Starts at 7:30, so come and see us. I have a sponsor, he's got a sponsor, and I sponsor guys. And I want to thank the group for having me here tonight. You know, I've done a lot of the right things in Alcoholics Anonymous for the wrong reasons. And wanting to be a speaker was one of them. So I got burned out on that, and so I'm going to do the best I can. And I'm going to try to wrap up my drunkalog as quick as I can. I grew up in L.A., and I went to Catholic school, had salt and pepper corduroy pants and a white shirt and a bow tie and shiny shoes. And we moved to San Diego when I was 11. And I got to do the last 3 months of sixth grade in public school. And I'm pretty sure that's why I'm an alcoholic. I went from a uniform to bell-bottom striped pants and paisley shirts and got to grow my hair out. And you know, my dad was really mean. He used to beat the snot at us. And the only time I saw him be fun was one time there was a party at our house. And I was about 10 or 11. And there was a bottle of Wild Turkey 101 dropped on the bar. We had a bar and a card room in that house. And he jumped up on the bar and was lapping it up like a dog. And he was having fun, and he was a different guy. And I'm thinking, man, there's something to that. So next day, I went and stole a couple of Pall Malls out of my mom's purse and poured a big glass of Wild Turkey and drank it down. And I'm like 11, puked all over the Korean grass outside. And that was the first time I got drunk. So when we moved to San Diego, you know, it was 1971. It was a really good time to be a blooming alcoholic drug addict. You know, started smoking pot, started drinking alcoholically when I was 12. You know, by the time I was 16, school was just in the way. And I was just, you know, we were stealing cars and motorcycles and doing residential burglaries, just normal kid stuff. And by the time, you know, when I was 13, I started smoking heroin. And I totally believe in our singleness of purpose here, and I'm going to stick to alcohol as much as I can, but I did a lot of drugs, and you're going to hear about it. Yeah, I started smoking heroin when I was 13 and started slamming when I was 17. But I took a proficiency test, which after you're 18, you take a GED. Before you're 18, you take a proficiency test, and you get the equivalent of a diploma. And like I said, the mid-70s was a great time to be a blooming alcoholic drug addict. I got out of school, 1976, 16 years old, and minimum wage was $1.75 an hour, and we were making big bucks because we were getting $2 an hour cash. And I started shoveling concrete, and I've been doing that for 43 years. But, you know, that was $16 a day. You know, you could buy a five-finger lid for $10. That's a bag of marijuana. And you could buy a hit acid for $2 and a rack of speed for $1 and a cord of East Side for 55 cents and get a nickel back on the bottle. I mean, how much money do you need? You know? And so anyway, you know, for me, becoming a total basket case drunken drug addict was like, it's like the limit on a credit card for me. It's not really a limit, it's a goal, you know? And I got in a lot of trouble, you know? God's got a pretty good sense of humor. I was in and out of juvenile hall a lot, and some stuff happened, and I hated cops and I hated blacks. And when we moved to San Diego, my mom married a black cop. Yeah. So, anyway. Yeah, it's funny. I was telling Tony earlier today, we had a spiritual meeting under his tree out in his yard. That's a pretty cool place, and he's a pretty cool dude. We had a great time. And was talking about, I don't know, you know, when we first moved to San Diego, we would go back to L.A., and I thought it was to visit my sister, but it was really so my mom could see her boyfriend, you know. And me and my brother were, you know, hitchhiking all over the place. And I remember I went over to my brother's friend's house because he had a little brother that was my age. And I walked in their house, and I'm looking around for Dudley was his name. I'm looking around for Dudley. And I went downstairs, and Kurt, my brother's friend, was sitting on the couch. And I remember like it was yesterday, Rolling Stones, Can't You Hear Me Knocking, was playing. And Kurt was sitting on the couch in front of a fireplace. There's a quart of Jack Daniels and a spoon, and he's just pulling a rig out of his arm, and he's nodding out on that couch, and that music's playing. And I'm a 12-year-old kid, and I'm thinking, I can't wait to do that. Where does that kind of thinking come from, you know? I was a little Catholic kid, you know? I don't know where that comes from, but that's how I thought. So as I'm getting older, I saw guys that were older than me getting married and having kids and going to prison and all of that. And I, you know, that looked good to me. Those guys, I looked up to those guys. So by the time I was 23, I'd been married and divorced twice. Had my first son. And anyway, a year after I moved out from her is when I started trying to get sober, and I bounced. I'd always come in on Mondays with a hellacious hangover, something sticking out of the truck, you know, hit something, wreck something, empty wallet, hadn't paid the rent, armful of holes, and I'd come into AA on Mondays. And there was times where I really wanted to get sober, and there was times I was just trying not to go to prison. But I bounced in and out for 5 years, and I could never get 30 days. And, you know, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I would hear people talking about that alcohol had quit working. And I'm like, what does that mean? I know what it means now. Because the difference between somebody who's an alcoholic and somebody who isn't an alcoholic is that alcohol does something to somebody who's not an alcoholic. They get drunk, they fall down, whatever. Alcohol does something for me. Alcohol, after a few drinks, the sense of ease and comfort comes, you know? And the reason that that is because it changes my perception of the world around me. I'm not really that asshole. I'm not really a bad guy for not seeing my kid that weekend. The landlord's rich. He can wait for his rent. I didn't want that job anyway. That's what happens to me after a couple drinks. And I need that because the truth is too painful. What I turned into and what I've done to people is too painful. I didn't consciously drink to change my perception of reality. I just drank all the time. And we all thought we were Leonard Skinner. Everybody had hair down to their ass, and we're all, you know, doing the deal. And so anyway, on my last run started on December 24th, Christmas Eve of 1988. And my sobriety date is January 3rd of 89. And like Rod was saying, didn't Rod do a good job?
Yeah.
That was awesome. That was awesome. Thank you. He's starting to tell the truth. I really appreciate that. So my wife had moved into this apartment complex across the street from where I lived. And I didn't see my son that Christmas. And alcohol stopped working. You know, those few days I didn't eat. I just drank Coors and Cuervo Gold. And I had a quarter pound of cocaine and a party pack of 100 syringes. And I just drank and drank and drank and smoked and smoked and smoked. And nothing was changing who I was. Nothing was changing my circumstances. Nothing was changing the way that I looked at anything. And when I party like that, I used to call it partying, menage a uno, I start hallucinating. And I see things underneath my skin and they need to come out. So when I really party, I look like a pepperoni pizza. And on January 2nd, that morning when I got up, you know, everywhere I could reach was a scab. My back, my face, underneath my hair. A vision for you, newcomers. So what happened that night was I had been up for days, and how shitty I felt about myself and knowing how I had hurt people, my mom, my wives, my kid. Everybody. You can't wash it off in the shower. And alcohol isn't doing anything. And doing a shitload of cocaine doesn't help either. But I, you know, that night I did my, that night I was laying in bed vibrating. And there was this huge ass rat in the corner of my room. And I knew if I moved, it was going to jump on me. And I stared at that thing all night, and I didn't want to dare get up and pee or anything else, because that rat was going to get me. And as the sun came up in the morning, I saw it was a pair of socks rolled up in the corner. I got up that morning, and I looked at myself in the mirror, because what was different about that Monday morning was that all those other Monday mornings, there was guilt and remorse and shame. All those Monday morning things that we have. And the thought was, I need to do something. I need to do something about this. And I can't. I can't any more today than I could then. We can, but I can't. So anyway, I got up and I looked at myself in the mirror, and what was different about that Monday morning is there was no more fight. There was no more guilt. There was no more remorse. I just said, F it. I'm going to die like this, and I don't care. That's called surrender. I surrendered. Alcohol was my master. And I don't know how long it was, but I started just uncontrollably sobbing. And I had this, it was a funky little apartment. Remember that, Rod? I had this funky little apartment. I went and knelt down in this sunny spot next to my dining room table. And I said, God, please don't let me live like this anymore. And I called a buddy of mine. He's been my best friend since I was 13. He's still my best friend today. And I heard, nobody trusted me anymore. The dope people didn't trust me anymore. No, I was, you know, I had a pretty promising criminal career at one point in my life, and I just became a disgusting drunk, and nobody trusted me anymore. I hadn't talked to James in a couple of years, and I heard through the grapevine that he was sober, and I called him up. And he came over that day, and he gave me the most precious thing that any of us can give each other. He gave me his time. He didn't know shit about Alcoholics Anonymous, but he came over and did that act of love. You know? He gave me his time. He helped me clean up my place. We got rid of everything. The weed, even the weed, really? He's like, yeah, we got to get rid of everything. So we got rid of everything. And I had bought a train set for my son. that I didn't see that Christmas, and he helped me put it on a sheet of plywood, and Michael came over that afternoon. That's my son. And I was too embarrassed of the way I looked to go to an AA meeting. Plus, I was still loaded. Not that that matters. Come to AA meetings loaded. It's okay. You know, that actually saved my life in the beginning, because all they told me was keep coming back. That's why when we sing Happy Birthday, I stop at keep coming back. Because I don't care if you're loaded. I shot a lot of dope in a parking lot. I went to a lot of meetings drunk. You know, just keep coming back. Anyway, I went to a meeting that night, and I got involved with a bunch of guys that didn't care about my feelings. They cared about what I did, and I was willing to do anything. I didn't come in here to stop drinking. I came in here because I couldn't stand another second of myself. And I was willing to do whatever it took to change that. And I went to 7 meetings a week and had commitments at all of them. I was 28, and got real involved with the young people's committees. We used to put on all the New Year's dances, and we'd travel all over the place doing Akipa and Ikipa and all that stuff. And it was, I started having a life. I was, all that money I was sticking in my arm, I started buying, back then it was like Duran Duran music and stuff. I had all these monkey suits and stuff. And anyway, I started buying clothes and getting dressed up for these dances and AA events, and it gave me something to do. And having those commitments saved my life. I believe that's what spiritual action is. And I believe that our whole process of the steps is solely about getting to the truth, straightening out the past, and continuing to live in the truth. Must be an important phone call. So, because I think that all of our steps have to do with really 2 things. They say it different ways. They talk about the truth and the false. They talk about consciousness and unconsciousness. They talk about sanity and insanity. But it really has to do with living in the truth or living a lie. And my whole life was a lie. My whole life was a lie because the truth was just too painful. And I needed something to change my reality. So, I'm with these guys and I have all these commitments and doing all this stuff, and I got sober in January, so commitments come up in like July, right? 6 months later. And I told my sponsor, I said, I'm not sure I want to keep all these commitments. I think I'm going to change it up a little bit. He says, why is that? And I said, I'm just not sure I want to put all my eggs in one basket. And he says, Tom, a guy like you only has one egg. And it better be the God that you find through the action you're taking in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he couldn't have been more right. My relationship with the God that I have in my life today is from putting away chairs. It's from shaking hands at the door. It's from doing this when I don't want to. It's from being a GSR when I don't want to. It's from answering the phone. It's from, all the stuff that we do. And, I think that it's really important to tell the truth. I'd hear people up here and when I was new and their lives sounded perfect. And I'd sit out there and go, what's wrong with me? My life's not like that. I know today that they were lying. But, I think that this is about identification. And when we can talk about our flaws, we can talk about our faults. Even 30 years sober, I have a ton of flaws, and that I deal with on a regular basis. But I don't have to do it alone. Because when we tell the truth, I don't feel alone. I know that you do it too. I know that you have that stuff too. And my whole perception of God and all that has changed a lot, I've done all kinds of different meditation stuff. I've done all kinds of different retreats. Over the years, I've done all kinds of different spiritual things. And I know today that the best meditation you can do is the one that you do. It's like my house looks like an infomercial. I have every piece of exercise equipment that's on TV. But obviously, it doesn't do any good unless you use it, So whether it's a breathing technique, whether it's a mantra, whatever it is, you know. And I used to have, you know, the God that I grew up with was this super punishing God. And that's not the God I have in my life today. My perception of that, you know, my perception of that church was that. And I see a lot of people that get a lot of relief and a lot of comfort out of the Catholic Church. So I'm not knocking the Catholic Church. It was me, you know. But I think that there's a little chunk of God in you. And I think there's a little chunk of God in me. And when those chunks get together, they're powerful than either one of us alone. And a group like this, it's really magnificent. We aren't separate. We're all one. We're all one beat. We're all the same. You know, and I've wasted so much time in my life thinking I was different. And I'm alone. And I'm the only one that feels this way. And we get to come here and talk about stuff like that out loud. And it helps, you know. We get to change lives. That's an amazing gift, to turn something so treacherous and so horrible into such a gift. I hope, if anything else, I tell my story to people and they don't believe me. They're like, you? I don't see, looking at you, you don't look like that, you know. And that is evidence of what God can do in a man's life. And if I can help change any man or woman's life in any way, that's the only reason I'm still alive, is to be of service to you. So, I'm not sure what else to say, man. And I don't know how long I've been talking. But one thing that started happening, I'll tell you about, in sobriety, was I started getting responsible. And I got sober in 89. I hadn't filed taxes since 83. I owed the IRS a lot of money. And I owed a lot of other people a lot of money. And I was working and working and working. I did my ninth step, and my sponsor says, pick out the three that you don't want to do the worst. So number one was my first wife's dad. He screwed up. He trusted me. And I'm a 19-year-old kid with hair down to my ass marrying his daughter. And I'm telling him how good I'm going to be to her. And I wasn't, you know. And for some reason, I had more shame and guilt with that than anything else. So I went to them first. And I said, you know, I'm really sorry what happened. And if there's anything I can do to make it right, I will. And this was before making amends to her. And they said, you know, they were from Oklahoma. Actually, he was the vice president of the Carpenters Union and had a bunch of oil wells in Oklahoma. And he was head of the engineering department for the city of San Diego. So they were perfect for me. And I took advantage of him. They said, we know you were just a dumb kid and we love you, Tom. That did not go how I knew it was going to go in my head for years. I knew how that was going to go when I saw them. I knew what was going to happen with the IRS when I saw them. I paid them for years, and my balance was going up. And my sponsor says, well, go. How can you make more money? I said, you know, I guess I could get a license. He says, well, go get a license. So I went and got a contractor's license. And I had a license, and I put an ad in a Penny Saver. It was this big, and it cost $35. And it was out for 3 days. And this lady calls me up and she says, you know, we did 385 houses last year and I fired my concrete guy this morning. Do you want to come and talk to us? And my business went insane. So Rod's ex-wife and my ex-wife were still at it. And I ended up, Michael was 5 when I got sober, my son. And I ended up getting custody of him when he was 7. And also, in my first year of sobriety, actually in my first months of sobriety, in like August of 88, I had brought this girl home from a bar. Fill in the blank. So I, one night thing, actually it was 2 days until my dope was gone. But in January, she calls me up and she says, hey, remember me? And I go, yeah, kind of, you know. And she says, well, I want to come over. I said, I'm not going to be any fun. I'm not drinking anymore. And she said, well, I've found the Lord. So she came over and, you know, within 20 minutes, she had lost the Lord. And my daughter, although there was talk of God, my daughter was conceived that night, and so I'm 11 months sober and have a new daughter. And I was out working on that prison that Rod was talking about. I was out at Calpat for a while, and I thought she was daddy hunting because I made money, and I was in fear, you know. I finally did a paternity test when Hannah was a year old, and then I got a bigger house, and I had Michael, and I was going to be having Hannah, and I told Michael, we were driving down the road, we had matching mullets, he had a Scooby-Doo shirt on with the sleeves cut off, and we're bouncing down the road in my 65 Ford truck. And I said, Michael, because by this time I'm super AA dad, I'm on the governance board at his school, I'm coaching baseball teams, and it's pretty gross. So anyway, I said, I know how to be a dad to a boy, but it looks like your sister is going to be around, and I don't know how to be a dad to a daughter. And he scooted over, and he put his arm around me, and he says, we can do it, Dad. And we did, you know. On Hannah's second birthday, I went to go see her. And her mom could barely talk. And she was in this funky-ass apartment. And there was no furniture, no food. It was November 4th, and it was an unusually hot day. She had on a sweater that used to be white that was black. She had shit running out of her diaper. And her mom says, two guys came in my apartment last night, and one of them took me in the bathroom and raped me, and the other one had Hannah out in the living room, and I don't know what happened to her. And you're going to have to take her. So I took her home, and I gave her a bath, and I looked at her. She didn't look, you know, violated to me. I took her to Mervyn's. I don't know if anybody remembers Mervyn's. Took her to Mervyn's and bought her a bunch of clothes and a bunch of stuffed animals and stuff. And by this time, I had had a room set up in that house for her, expecting that I was going to be spending time with her. I didn't know I was going to get her. You know? That's a lot of responsibility. And none of that stuff did I do alone, man. The women in Alcoholics Anonymous helped me. The men in Alcoholics Anonymous helped me. You taught me how to be a dad. You taught me how to be a good guy. Although I did abuse having two little kids and being a single dad. It was like having a puppy at the beach. It's like, oh, can I make you dinner and come over and do your laundry? It's like, okay. Anything else? So I had them for a little while and started looking around and saying, shit, I need a wife. So I got married again, and her and I had two kids together 14 months apart. And my business was going psycho. I was making a ton of money. And I became so unconscious that I thought I was doing the right thing. I'm working 7 days a week, 90 hours a week. And I have a new young wife with two babies and two stepkids. And I basically abandoned her, you know. And I, in my head, I'm doing the right thing, building this empire for my family, which really wasn't shit. But I, you know, in my mind it was. And in my mind, I was really doing the right thing. And when we were both 10 years sober, we got divorced. And it was a really hard way to learn the difference between the price of things, having money, and the value of things. You know, I used to stand over them like a proud rooster. And when that was gone, it had a really gnarly effect on me. And I had backed off of AA. It was work, 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 money, 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 money. And it almost killed me. After we got divorced, she started drinking again, and I had to take those boys. So I had four kids. So I built that house up in Alpine, There's a kick-ass Halloween party up there on the 26th, by the way. Shameless plug there. You guys help me. You guys help me with that. Any of that stuff, the business, the kids, the parenting, anything that's good in my life is because of you. It's because the God in you and the God in I connect. And I don't have to be alone. And I know that there's help out there. You know, in a spiritual experience in Appendix 2, it talks about, a spiritual experience. And I think that starts with that Monday morning I was talking about. Because all those other Monday mornings, I'm saying, I can do something about this. And I think that spiritual shift starts when you say, I can't. I need help. You know? And I need just as much help today. And anyway. So I have all these kids. And, we motorcycles and buggies and quads and all that. And we go to the desert in the winter, and I had a house at the river. We go to the river in the summer. And we spend a lot of time in my truck. And we have a lot of different discussions because we're on the road for 3 hours at a time. One time we were coming back and we were on 2nd Street, and for some reason the traffic was totally stopped, and we were in the far right lane, and there's like a bike lane on the very far right. And that day we were talking about God, and particularly we talked about God a lot, but we were particularly talking about heaven and hell. And they said, do you believe in heaven and hell? I said, well, kind of. They said, what do you mean? And I said, I think that heaven is in your heart and hell is in your head. And they said, what do you mean? Jacob, my youngest, is really curious. He's the one with all the questions. He says, what do you mean? I said, well, this is a bad question to ask your kids. I said, have you ever stolen anything or lied? And I'm like, yeah. And I say, you know how you're thinking about it all the time, what's going to happen when you see that person, or if somebody finds out, you're going to get in trouble and all this, and you just, it's in your head. And I think that's what hell is. And so this whole time we're having this conversation, there's this convertible Cadillac, and I see it in my right-hand mirror way back there, and it's this huge woman in a convertible Cadillac, and she's pulling up about every four cars, and she's leaning out the window, and she's yelling at the car next to her. And we're having this conversation. I'm watching this lady move up and up and up in the mirror. And she said, well, what do you think heaven is? I said, anytime that you can lighten somebody's load, anytime you can bring a smile to somebody's face, anytime you can be of service to somebody else, I think that's what the truth is. I think that's what we're supposed to do here. And I think that's what heaven is. And right then, that fat lady pulled up next to us, and she starts yelling. Ah, you see all the meat on her face shaking. She's yelling at us, slobber flying around like a dog. And Jake was in the front passenger seat, and he turns around and he goes, that lady's really in hell. Anyway, this is heaven to me. This is, you are my heaven. You are where I get centered. You are where I get to experience love. You are where I get to experience God. And there's no amount of money, there's no amount of inconvenience, there's no amount of time that I could ever give Alcoholics Anonymous that would make me even. Thank you for the opportunity to be here tonight.